Yes, you have to wear masks now, but dentistry is still dentistry. Tree surgery is still tree surgery. Your accounts are still going to be prepared by your accountant and you'll sign them. The impact on communication has been absolutely monumental.
This is Can Do, a podcast that explores the business lessons essential for success in these volatile times. Can Do shares the insights of industry experts, along with the experiences and advice of local businessmen and businesswomen. Whether you're a business owner, an entrepreneur, or your career is affected by the current economic climate, these lessons will give you the guidance you need to make informed decisions about your future. I'm your host, Arnie Sherman. Most of what we know about communication is wrong, says Tim Pollard, author, speaker, founder, and CEO of Iridium. In his books, The Compelling Communicator and Mastering the Moment, Tim outlines how the brain communicates information. More importantly, he details how to successfully design and execute communication in ways that people will understand. At Iridium, Tim has applied his communication expertise to companies as diverse as IBM, Cisco, and Disney. Based in Billings, Montana, Iridium specializes in executive communication, sales messaging, and online communication training. Today on Can Do, Tim will share how business communication has changed in the virtual age. We'll also explore the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on effective messaging architecture. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And from Parsons, Bailey, and Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. Tim, welcome to the show. For our audience who haven't heard your accent yet, you are obviously not a Billings native. Can you tell us about your career path? And then how did that lead you to found Iridium in Billings 10 years ago?
I had a fairly classical pathway through a sales and marketing career, spanning the UK, a little time in Mexico, and then in the US. I did a lot of consulting work across that time. I'd been in Washington, D.C. for about 15 years and kind of needed a break. And so I actually came briefly to work for a really lovely little nonprofit in Billings, Montana. That was a great 4 or 5 years. But then I started this company, a communications consulting firm, and was not going to leave Montana, and actually managed to make that work quite well. So we're a global company, but actually based in Billings.
And what's the focus of Iridium?
The main focus of Iridium is quite interesting, I think. Everyone needs to communicate effectively, but hardly anyone does. And the reasons we communicate poorly are not the reasons most people think. You know, we think, oh, we've got to have great eye contact and body language. And in fact, that is entirely the wrong answer. Great communication is about the structure, the architectural structure of a message. And it is particularly about whether that architectural structure aligns with the way the brain actually consumes information. So what we do is we've developed a particular model, or several models, but a particular model that allows people to structure communication in a way that will be extremely effective, because it's going to align very well with the way that the brain consumes information. So most of what we do actually is help organizations with their sales messaging, how they tell their sales story. There's very immediate commercial impact from doing that. We also do a lot of work, though, with executive communications, helping senior executive structure, you know, internal messages, messages to Wall Street, but also nonprofits with donor messaging, and we even coach TED speakers. So what we do is we help people architect arguments to make them much, much more effective.
Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah, imagine you were reading a book and you read chapter 4. It makes perfect sense. Why? Because chapter 3 preceded it, created the context for it. And the brain does extremely well with a well-sequenced narrative, does very badly with a poorly sequenced narrative. If you read the same book, imagine you read Lord of the Rings, but you read it out of sequence, it wouldn't make any sense at all, but it's exactly the same content. And the problem is you'd be reading it with no context. I look at slide decks built by sales organizations, leaders everywhere. There's never a storyline. It's slide, follow slide, follow slide. It's what we call a topic-driven narrative. And it is almost perfectly incomprehensible to the brain. You literally cannot remember information when you don't have any prior context. If you're interested, it's why you forget names when you're introduced to someone for the first time. If I said to you, oh, my name's Tim, and you say, oh, my name's Arnie, unless I had context, if my dad was called Arnie or my brother, the brain cannot store information for which it has no prior context. It doesn't just have random filing bins. It needs context to store information. Almost all presenters fail to create a logical through line to their argument, and it's why almost everything that's presented is almost immediately forgotten. And the answer is you build a strong, logical, linear narrative, then each piece of your argument makes sense because it was set up by the preceding piece. And you go from a completely forgettable argument to a completely memorable argument. That's just one rule of the brain drives a very important communications principle.
How did you learn about the architecture of the brain and the architecture of creating messaging?
That's a very interesting question. So it started with a problem. I worked for a large research firm in Washington, D.C. We did these very significant, very substantial, I should say, research studies, which we presented to our members. So I ran the sales and marketing practice. So we would get heads of sales of Fortune 500 companies together, and we would present these research findings to them. But these were eight-hour meetings. Well, around the time we were doing that, the common accepted wisdom was you couldn't hold someone's attention for more than 30 to 40 minutes. So I started thinking about, well, is it actually possible to hold someone's attention for 8 hours? And so I started to look at why communication succeeds when it succeeds, why it fails when it fails. And I began to uncover that there were very distinct rules to how the brain works. And in fact, if you align with the way the brain works, you could create breathtakingly good communications and hold the attention span of people whose typical span is that of a kitten for about 7 or 8 hours. And so from that time, I began to distill out the rules of great communication. And I just spent the last 15, 20 years refining those down to a model. I think there are two other parts to that. There are very interesting places you can go looking for clues as to why communication works. You know, there were hundreds, certainly, of medieval authors. Why does Shakespeare survive when almost none others do? Why are certain passages from Shakespeare memorable? Why do you remember a line like, to be or not to be, that is the question, whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against the sea of troubles and by opposing end them? How can I remember that? It's because Shakespeare used a very specific linguistic device, and it shows up in almost everything he wrote that was memorable. So, friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is often buried with their bones. You wouldn't necessarily notice, but those two passages, one from Hamlet, one from Julius Caesar, use exactly the same linguistic device, which is antithesis. If I set two ideas against each other, that's catnip to the brain. It's catnip to the brain. The brain loves antitheses. It chews on them. So I found that out, and then I started looking for them. Well, lo and behold, they show up everywhere. You know, ask not what you can, your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And what you find is where antithesis shows up, it's highly memorable to the brain. A very large amount, significant amount of what we remember from historical communication, we remember because it was antithetical. So that was just a line of pursuit that was from looking into why certain literature is memorable. And then you find similar rules emerging from stand-up comedy and things like that. So I think I'm a naturally very inquisitive person. So I started looking under all of these rocks and learned these different things, then was just fortunate enough to be able to assemble them into a model that combined all of the best learning about how the brain works. It was also very helpful that in the last 10 years, because of the invention of the fMRI, the functional MRI, we can actually see how the brain lights up when it's exposed to different stimuli. Well, you can actually see what's happening in the brain when different types of communication are received by the brain. We actually did a study here. We measured brain activity based on different types of communication. And guess what? Bulleted PowerPoints, where the bullets have no sequence, where it's a slide after slide after slide. The brain just hates them, does not know where to go looking for a through line, a theme, or a big idea. So it's a longer answer than you probably wanted, but it was a probably 20 years of exploration of a very wide range of very eclectic sources.
So how has the virtual age changed communication? We're talking about Shakespeare in written form, and then there were plays on the stage, and you know, you studied in school, but the virtual age must have had a significant impact on, and continues to have a significant impact on how messages are communicated.
It's astonishing. I think it is at this point completely underappreciated and misunderstood. I would argue that the virtual environment that was thrust upon us from spring of 2020, and by the way, this is here to stay. The COVID just accelerated a trend of communication to go virtual. It didn't create it. All sales meetings from now to eternity are probably going to stay virtual. I think the transformation, the impact on communications might be greater than the impact on almost any other profession. I mean, yes, you have to wear masks now, but dentistry is still dentistry. Tree surgery is still tree surgery. Your accounts are still going to be prepared by your accountant and you'll sign them. The impact on communication has been absolutely monumental. And I think what's interesting here is it's almost completely misunderstood. Most people feel the key to communicating in a virtual environment is mastering the platform. And you and I can jokingly say we took 15 minutes to get the platform working today. And, you know, mastering the platform is important. You know, people are still making really, really dumb mistakes. They set up with a window directly behind them and they're completely invisible. And it's an unprofessional, dumb look. And they don't know how to share their screen and they don't know how to... They don't know, for example, that you should always try and schedule meetings in the morning and you should always try and start your meetings on the half hour. And you should always, by the way, try and get the meeting onto the platform you know best and then you can control glitches. So there's a lot of great lessons about mastering the platform. But that's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing is this. Communication is a profoundly social process. And what has happened is it's moved into a profoundly asocial environment. And that is what has sent so many people into a tailspin. I'll give you four ways in which the virtual environment is profoundly different from a social dynamic standpoint. Number one, people are so distracted. If I am not sharing faces and I can't see you, you could be petting the cat, playing with the dog, probably checking three other devices for email. And you're creating what you'd call cognitive fractures. You're tuning out of my comments for just even a few seconds. Your actual ability to understand any moderately complex argument evaporates when you do that. In a live room, it's socially difficult for you to just look away from me and pick up your phone and start doing other things, although I've seen it happen. In a virtual meeting, it's absolutely continuous. It's constant. So the cognitive breakdown that happens is huge. By the way, I want to give you some tips and advice as we go through. One of the things you want to do is make sure you're always sharing video. You're always seeing faces. I'm looking at you now and I can see you're engaged. And what that means is you've got to get away from slides, because if you present slides, then the slide becomes the main event. The person you're talking to might be totally distracted. The second thing is interesting, and there's already research on this. There's a profound drop in your cognitive bandwidth. Yeah, you know, Arnie, you didn't get stupid when you jumped on this Zoom call, and neither did I, but you kind of did. It's so exhausting. And the point is the focus you have to put into this screen, you have to tune everything else out. It's exhausting. It's exhausting both for audiences and for communicators. And what that means is the general lesson we have always taught in a pre-COVID environment about simplifying your message, that's just been significantly amplified. You've got to simplify to a very great extent, not because your audience is stupid, but because they actually have less mental bandwidth to give. Hence, I said earlier, always schedule any meeting you can in the morning, because at least get on the right side of the Zoom fatigue curve. You try and talk to a customer 3 o'clock in the afternoon, their time, they've got no gas left in their tank if they've been on meetings all day, which most of them have. Also, funnily enough, what I've learned, we teach a lot of classes. I was incredibly comfortable for the last decade teaching an 8-hour class, and I still had gas in my tank at the end of the day to go for a beer and chat with a group. We will not today teach any class longer than 3 hours because the audience is exhausted, but so am I. After 3 hours of teaching in an online studio, it's just absolutely exhausting. So you have to adjust your communication to reflect mental bandwidth. The third one is, to me, the most interesting. It may not be the most important, it's the most interesting, is the complete disappearance of social feedback and social cues. I'll give you an example. People ask me all the time, this is our main area of expertise is sales messaging. They ask me all the time, what do I think makes for a great salesperson? They always think I'm going to say a great communicator. I don't think that. Lots of amazing salespeople are solid communicators at best. Do you know what all great salespeople have as their core skill? They have very high social IQ. I'm actually looking at you now. I know this is an audio recording, but I'm looking at you and I can see if you're engaged or disengaged. If you're a customer and you're one of four people on this call and you're nodding and affirming what I'm saying, a great salesperson will say, oh, no, Arnie, I can see you're agreeing with that. Tell me about that. And then you might say, oh, yeah, Tim, you know, I worked with you at a previous company. I know your solution works. And see how I can build momentum for the sale that way. Or if I'm looking at you, Arnie, and you are just skeptical, arms folded, frowning, leaning back, but I also know you're the head of finance, I'm like, Arnie, I can see you're not completely happy with what I'm saying. Tell me about that. And then you'll voice your concern. It might be a misunderstanding. It might be a real objection, but I can draw it out. Communication is very rarely a one-way process. It's a dynamic, complex dance between communicators and audiences. And in the virtual environment, especially if you're not showing faces, almost all of that feedback goes away, and which is devastating. I can't read your reaction. I can't respond dynamically in the moment. And yet all great communicators, whether sales or executive, they're in tune with their room because of this dynamic of social IQ. And they know how to read and they know how to respond. And again, there are things you can do there. Number one, always be sharing faces. The other part of that I find personally fascinating, when the world went virtual, we were asked two questions by everybody. One of them we expected and one of them we did not expect. The one we expected was, how do I modify my sales messaging for a virtual environment? And we're all over that. We totally know how to answer that. The second one we now know how to answer, but it was really took us by surprise. And it was this, how do I build trust in a virtual environment? I mean, people buy things, but they still, even in business-to-business settings, they buy from people. If I'm pitching you a $100,000 solution to fix your sales messaging, at some level, you have to trust me that what I'm saying we can do, we can do. Well, the biggest problem we're seeing is that trust and credibility collapse in this flat, one-dimensional environment. And that can be solved, but it can be solved. You'd be surprised how interesting the solutions are. Number one is language. I need to establish credibility with you. One of the ways I do that is with linguistic precision. If I articulate my argument well and clearly and precisely, not only do I need to do that because I've got to make it work in this narrow environment, but we've actually proven a correlation between trust and quality of language. So if I'm using bland, pedestrian, halting language with a lot of ums and ahs and I'm fumbling to get my argument out clearly, your trust in me or my credibility will collapse. And then that rabbit hole goes very deep, Alice. We talk also a lot about authority and authenticity as means of building trust. There are things you need to do in response to this collapsed social environment. And then the fourth one I won't get into, but the fourth one's interesting, which is the loss of the hallway conversation. If you're a salesperson, and you go visit a big customer, some of the conversations after the meeting, in the break when you go for coffee, while you're setting up, are so vital. I might learn something about, oh, you know, watch out for Bob in the room, he's going to torpedo you, or he's in love with your main competitor, or, oh, you know what, that comment that Susan made, you might want to follow up with her on that, otherwise that's going to stick with her. A lot of communication has these peripheral satellite moments. And they go away. When we hang up now, there is no corridor conversation. I don't get to chat with Beth Ann or Peter or something like that. So anyway, again, I'm specializing in long answers today. But the main point is mastering the platform, yeah, do it. And we can teach you how to do that. But the thing you've really got to do is make a major adaptation to reflect a completely different social dynamic. And it's just wildly interesting.
The point you just made, Tim, about the accidental learning that happens when you're face-to-face, in person, it's important. But what about the intimacy issue? I mean, part of being an effective salesperson or effective leader is, you know, pressing the flesh, so to speak, and, you know, often going off track,
yeah,
picking up nonverbal clues and using that to, you know, to press a point or move in one direction or another. How do you replace that in the virtual world?
That's very interesting. I mean, three or four things to say there, I think. One of them is that really does come back to the intimacy, I think, is just another word for trust, credibility, for that human connection that gets lost. There's an interesting misunderstanding in communication. Everyone talks about, well, 75% of communication is nonverbal. That's complete nonsense. It's based on a misunderstanding of a 1979 study, which I think, if I remember right, it was called the Likert study. That study has been widely misquoted. That study said that a high proportion of someone's likability is affected by nonverbal cues. In other words, whether you like someone. That has nothing to do with their communications effectiveness. Whereas people have taken that to mean that, oh, 79% of communication is nonverbal. That's absolute nonsense. I mean, if you closed your eyes now and just listened to me, you would get everything out of this conversation with no reference to nonverbal cues. So you can way overestimate that. I mean, we teach the best companies in the world how to communicate. In a two-day workshop, we'll spend a combined total of about 2 minutes on eye contact and body language. Don't chase that snipe. It's a waste of time. Now, the point, though, of intimacy in the sense of building relationship, though, that is important. As I said, the way you do that is, I think, through – it's actually four things. I've mentioned sort of three of them, but one of them is the way you use language – builds intimacy and credibility, particularly. We did a big study of all the various elements of style, and we correlated them with a speaker's natural warmth, with your ability to feel warm towards them. The study is described in the second book quite well. And what we really found was four things: language. The second one was enthusiasm or passion. People are naturally drawn to passionate people. Something we teach is, your audience is never going to be more excited about this stuff than you are. So if you're not excited about, passionate about what you're presenting, that is going to come across. And so you have to have a certain heightened energy and enthusiasm level. And what we now believe is you've got to amp that up even a little bit more in the virtual environment because it's so flat. A great metaphor for you here is any movie actor is taught to some extent to minimize their physicality. You don't over-egg it. But a theater actor is never taught that. A theater actor emphasizes gesture and facial expression, because if you're at the Globe Theater in London and the cheap seats are 250 feet away from the stage, you're not going to see a subtle raise of the eyebrow. So injecting a certain amount of passion and energy, showing that you're excited about this stuff, really matters. You don't go over the top, but it's going to be a little higher than it would perhaps be in a live environment, a face-to-face environment. The third thing, as I said, is authority. One of the things that builds relationship is authority. If you said to me, oh, Tim, you know, I know a lot about communication. I really think eye contact and body language are important. That's a very interesting moment for me. If I bend and go, oh, you're probably right, Arnie, that actually will come across as weak and you won't like it. If I said, Arnie, you're a really nice guy, but if you don't mind, we'll have to agree to differ. I do not believe that eye contact and body language will get you anywhere. That little exchange changes your view of me if I exercise a certain degree of what we call gracious authority. I've got a great metaphor for that. Great metaphor. Have you ever been to a restaurant and you ask the waiter what's good? And he says, oh, it's all good. You hate that guy. You hate him because you know it's not all good, but he won't tell you. And so you completely dismiss him. If he said, look, Arnie, the steaks are okay here, but honestly, this pork chop, I'd crawl over broken glass to get this pork chop. Then you love that guy because he's giving you a recommendation. And that's a great metaphor that as a speaker, as a communicator, have a degree of authority, draw conclusions, have an opinion, hold your ground. Just don't be a jerk about it. Don't be a bully. If the customer says, well, okay, that sounds great, but I'm going to have the halibut, then you're like, okay, enjoy the halibut. That's great. There's a certain strength that we know really does contribute to warmth and relationship. And then the fourth one is authenticity. Authenticity is simply revealing that you are a human being underneath the business conversation. And that was, in fact, the highest correlate we found. In other words, speakers that showed a degree of appropriate authenticity or warmth were, that was the most important thing in terms of driving the sense people had of trust and, you know, like, oh, that's a guy I want to go talk to after the meeting. There's a wonderful example from history here, actually, and I'm not making any political comment, but look at the contrast in styles between Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. Politically, they were similar from a philosophical standpoint. But Hillary was very cold, and it was well known that she was kind of a cold presenter, did not reveal a lot of who she was. And the problem with that, whether it's Hillary or anyone, Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter. You have trouble trusting someone like that because you sense there's a mask you don't get to look behind. And that's difficult for people. Whereas if you look at Bill Clinton, he was a very effective communicator. And it was well known that he revealed a lot of his personal humanity. He would tear up. Do you remember the "I feel your pain" comment, which he originally coined? It was when some woman he was in a town hall with was communicating some personal tragedy she'd been through. And that empathy, that warmth, was a very important driver of his success as a communicator. Curiously, Churchill had that. Churchill, do you remember the movie about Churchill recently? I forget its name. But he said, I blub all the time. And it was true. Churchill would tear up a lot. And again, one of the last century's finest communicators had this degree of personal authenticity. So I think it was worth going through those. If you can do those four things, it will really drive up the connection that you can create even across this great gulf of space that we're experiencing right now.
Most of the communicators, particularly leadership communicators, you haven't read your book, haven't taken your classes. And if they are effective, it's almost by accident. They weren't educationally trained to be effective because it's sort of a new and evolving way to look at communication, particularly the virtual age. So tell me, what leaders do you think communicate well and whose style you admire?
What you said is actually very true and very interesting. The communicators I see that are really effective, notice what they're not doing. They're not being effective because they're doing what classes teach. Think of this is really fascinating. Classes teach have eye contact and body language and power posing. Some of the worst communicators out there have the best eye contact and body language and posing. And again, it comes back to the fact that those are not really the things that matter. I think what you want to look for is probably two or three things. One is people that are genuine communicators as opposed to being heavily dependent on their technology, putting up slides and reading them. So Steve Jobs would be a perfect example. He would stand up, he would talk to an audience from the heart. You want to switch somebody off, fire up a slide deck and start narrating it. PowerPoint karaoke, we call that. The second thing I would just repeat a lot of what I've already said about a certain degree of authenticity. Jobs, again, was very authentic. I mean, particularly in the latter part of his life, and it was obvious he was sick. He didn't ignore or skirt that. You always, I think, if you want to be a great communicator, you always have to pay real attention to the architecture and structure of your message. Is it logical? Is it simple? Is it audience-centric or is it sender-centric? Am I talking all about me or am I talking about you and your problems and dreams and challenges and difficulties? That ability to be audience-centric or customer-centric is absolutely enormous. And then I think the fourth one, if I'm just thinking about communicators, and Jobs, again, by the way, was very good at that. The fourth one, I think, again, a lot of it comes down to authenticity and honesty. I think you see that current climate in Michelle Obama. I have a huge respect for Michelle Obama as a communicator. And there's just a grace and authenticity there. Again, if I look across all these common speakers, there'd be other less well-known ones. A lady just passed away who was just, I loved her. Her name was Eva Kaur. She was a Holocaust survivor. Probably by a margin, the finest communicator I ever saw, by a wide margin. 4'10", of Transylvanian descent. So she sounded a bit like Dracula, but she, as a young girl, was taken to Auschwitz. They did medical experiments on her because she was a twin. I mean, it was horrific. And in her later life, she was a speaker and she spoke on racial, ethnic and other tolerance from her point of view as having been captured and imprisoned by the Nazis. And it was extraordinary how good she was. And when you try and analyze why was she so good, her messaging was stunningly well architected. She would give a 2-hour lecture, but it pivoted on three big ideas. And we didn't get into this yet, but the brain traffics in ideas. You have to communicate at the level of ideas, and she would communicate at the level of ideas. Linguistic absolute linguistic precision. I watched her speak several times. It was uncanny how, when she got to one of her critical points, her wording was so precise. She had a phrase she would use. In Auschwitz, dying was easy. Living took every ounce of strength you had. And I became friends with her. I actually visited Auschwitz with her at one point. But I heard her speak on so many occasions. And at that moment, that was the phrase. And she understood that language matters. There's a difference between an average phrase and that maybe only one perfect phrase. And so she embodied that. She embodied that linguistic precision, that message architecture. She was also incredibly authentic. I mean, talking about what it was like as a 12-year-old girl to watch your family be murdered. And so I look at this sort of bundle of attributes that I would associate with the great communicator, and she had all of them and absolutely no training. And I actually believe one of the reasons she was so good was she didn't have corporate training. The moment you get sucked into PowerPoint hell, you may never escape. Well, I think a lot of our job is helping people understand you can be an extraordinary communicator and never open PowerPoint. I haven't opened PowerPoint in years. I'll open the decks clients send me so I can tell them how bad they are. But I would never present using PowerPoint. It's just it's a bad tool. It doesn't work.
We are speaking with Tim Pollard, author, speaker, and CEO of Iridium. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by Montana Rail Links, committed to safely delivering transportation solutions to their customers. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And from Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. So, Tim, why is there such confused understanding of the COVID health message? There's a certain portion of the population that just believes it's all a hoax. Recently, there was a piece on NPR about a woman nurse who was attending people that were dying from COVID, and they weren't willing to acknowledge that they were affected by it. What do you think's going on there?
Again, that's such an interesting question. I mean, I am not the expert on that particular narrow topic, but I think there's a very important force in play here, which is called confirmation bias. As you know, we are subject to a wide range of cognitive biases. So one of them is called diagnosis bias. You make a very quick decision as to whether you're going to engage with a particular person. And having decided, you don't then change your mind. So, for example, if you're a communicator and you mess up in the first couple of minutes, good luck. You're not getting the audience back. Diagnosis bias doesn't kill people in communications, but it's been known to kill people, unfortunately, in the airline industry. A pilot will decide a certain thing is wrong with his plane or her plane. And even though a mountain of evidence then unfolded to show them their initial diagnosis was wrong, they couldn't see it. They almost literally couldn't see it. There was a famous case where a pilot was convinced his right engine was on fire. And what had happened is some wiring had gotten crossed and his left engine was on fire. People were literally saying, "I'm looking out the window. The left engine is on fire." They were telling him that. But what he did, this happened in the UK, is he shut down the right engine. Well, of course, he has a left engine that's on fire. He then shuts down the right engine and the plane crashes. Why? Because this cognitive bias is so strong, it overrules a lot of our rationality. Now, why did I go there? Confirmation bias says we seek out the information that agrees with what we already think, and we tend to avoid information that doesn't. So I'm a middle-aged guy having a classic middle-aged crisis. So a couple of years ago, I buy a Jaguar sports car. I will avidly read any review that says it's an amazing car, and I kind of won't read the reviews that says it's a bad car because I have confirmation bias. I want to read things that agree with what I already believe. Now, go back 15, 20 years. Everyone had roughly the same information sources, right? You had ABC News, NBC News, CBS newspapers. They were not tailored to you. They were kind of the news. And so you would read it, and it sort of forces you to draw your own conclusions. I'm 59 years old. I grew up in the UK. I would watch BBC News. That was all there was. There was no internet when I was younger. And they would report. Now, I would have to figure out what I thought about that. Now, nobody's doing that anymore. I think this is the single most dangerous thing that's happening in communication today, which is you can dial into, metaphorically, the information sources, the news sources that perfectly align with what you already believe. again, I don't want to make this political. This is so much bigger than just politics. But if you naturally lean towards a conservative view, you might just only expose yourself to conservative news sources, which will feed back to you. So what's happening is confirmation bias has become very dangerously amplified. There are literally stories, the one you named, actually, of people who are dying. And as they're dying, they're saying, what happened here? I was told this wasn't serious. And of course, I'm not just picking on the right. It's exactly the same thing happens on the left. You can be someone who leans liberal. If you only connect yourself to more liberal news sources, you now are getting only information that feeds a liberal bias. And whatever that liberal bias is going to become absolutely entrenched. It's very difficult now. It's very, very difficult now to expose yourself to a news source that is genuinely independent. The only news source I read or try and focus on is Reuters. I find Reuters to be less editorial and more factual reporting because I want to read a story and I want to think about what I think about it. The interesting thing, and there was a great documentary on this, which has been circulating that everyone should watch. I think it was called The Social Dilemma. I think it's on Netflix or whatever it is now how this is completely pervasive. If you're on Facebook and you click on a link which is of one political point of view, it doesn't matter which, Facebook's algorithm recognizes that and it begins to feed the same kind of information to you, which I think drives an even greater polarization. And I think that's the big thing that's happening with COVID. People don't have an objective view of COVID based on emerging scientific thought, which obviously has changed. You know, we didn't know the disease very well in March, and we're learning more as we go. They have a view on COVID, which is entirely colored by the news sources they've exposed themselves to. And it's so subtle, you almost don't know it's happening. So unless you absolutely force yourself either to simultaneously consume news sources from different points of view. Like if you spend an hour on CNN and an hour on Fox, I mean, just go spend 10 minutes on CNN and 10 minutes on Fox, you'll realize there's two different planets you're living on. You know, they're not reporting on the same planet. The work you have to do now to try to understand what's happening objectively is almost more work than most people are willing to do.
And this has also found itself into the sort of the funnel to fake news and what's fake and what's not fake based on this same kind of phenomena.
Yeah, I mean, define fake news, right? I mean, there, in theory, there is such a thing as purely factual news, but language is highly loaded, right? The moment I comment on anything, the very language I'm using is going to provide some degree of interpretation. If I said something like, and you see this in the news all the day, and then President Trump said, brackets, without evidence, that this thing happened. Now, that's factual if he or anyone, doesn't matter who it is, or Biden said, without evidence that this thing happened. It might be factual. I made a statement and I didn't corroborate it with evidence. That's factual. But there's also a high degree of interpretation I can put on that statement because I can look at that statement and read between the lines and say, the president said, without evidence, dot, 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 like he always does, dot, 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 that this thing happened. In other words, there's a very fine line between factual information and interpretive information. And it's almost impossible to spot because cognitive biases are very difficult to spot. So I think this will be a real challenge for society. I have four kids in their 20s pretty much. Well, actually, yes, all in their 20s now. And I talk to them a lot about this, about where will you source your information on the world and how will you seek to make sure that you get to decide what it means by trying to strip it down to the original facts rather than relying on the interpretation of the source that created it. Because I think we're in a very dangerous society, honestly, when we cannot trust the information we're receiving. Because as you say, how is it possible that half the world, and this isn't just the US, you're seeing this in certainly in the UK and most of Western Europe, half the world thinks COVID's a scam or at some point not very important, and half the world think it's the zombie apocalypse. Like, it can only be one of those two. I think we're heading into uncharted territory because of the proliferation of unregulated information sources and our natural predisposition to lean into the ones that support what we already believe. That's dangerous reinforcement. No one will ever change their opinion in that world. No one will ever have their opinion challenged, and that's incredibly dangerous.
So, Tim, how do you change that world? If it's a dangerous place now, how do you change that?
I don't know. I don't know if it's possible to change it. I mean, I think change societally always begins with individuals, right? I mean, if for example, there were a radical shift to change, say, the situation of racial intolerance in the US, that's still going to be the aggregate of individual action, people standing up and saying, hey, I want to sign up for some forward movement in terms of greater racial reconciliation. The aggregate of people becomes society. The narrow answer isn't helpful. The narrow answer is what actually should happen is people should learn to think for themselves and say, I'm not going to simply consume information from a source which is going to tell me everything I want to hear, because I know that in that way I'm not ever going to be challenged. But to pick a topical political example, precisely the reverse is happening. Again, I'm not making a political comment here, but the US election just happened. Let's agree that it appears that Trump lost at the time of recording. That looks like that's now settled. There's an interesting moment in history where Fox News, which was largely a medium, a channel that President Trump really liked, and they were aligned and they would do a lot of interviews. Well, for whatever reason, I won't get into all of them, he's fairly unhappy with Fox, and he said a few things about Fox distancing himself from Fox. And what he's asking people to do is move further to the right, to go to other conservative media that are hardly more objective. They are just more pronounced in their right-wing position. I'm not saying any individual position is wrong. I mean, a news organization can have whatever position it wants to have. It can take a strongly left-wing or a strongly right-wing position. That's not for me to decide. But if the general trend now is for people to move into the more extreme channels to say, well, Fox isn't right-wing enough, Fox isn't conservative enough, I actually want to go to something like Newsmax, a little more to the right. It doesn't suggest people are moving more to the center to try and get there, try and find out what's happening without a degree of editorial bias. And again, I'm just picking that as an example. Exactly the same thing could be true on the left. If I have a very strong left-wing view or a fairly left-wing view, I might be, I don't really know what the right outlet is. I might be saying, consume news something like ABC. Well, let's just say hypothetically that's fairly left-wing. But then I feel like, oh, it's not left-wing enough, and I would then want to move, say, more to CNN. I think people are polarizing even more with their media choices. And I think if you're going to, honestly, if you're going to heal the country and the world, in fact, not just the US, and get to a debate where we can actually debate what's really going on and try and find some consensus and middle ground and less hostility, I think it actually would begin with people trying to find out facts, objective facts rather than highly editorialized facts. I don't know how that happens, because what you're seeing right now is, for example, on the right, there's a general shift from people away from Fox to more extreme right-wing media, and I'm not sure what that's going to mean in the end. I'm not especially hopeful as to whether the divisions you see, and it's happening in Serbia, and it's happening in Germany, and it's certainly happening in Sweden and Spain and Italy, mostly over how to deal with COVID, definitely happening in the UK and definitely happening in the US, that people's polarization over these issues is getting wider. There's a fascinating article on NPR recently about how many friendships have been destroyed by this increasing polarization. I'm not sure there's an easy answer for how to solve it.
There isn't an easy answer, obviously, but let me ask you this. How does this polarization on issues like COVID and, you know, your political leanings, how does that filter into sales and marketing messaging? I mean, in the virtual age, there has to be some determinant of all of this. And how is that playing out?
I think, fortunately, you don't see a big bleed or overlap or infringement of political topics and political issues into the sales and marketing space. If I'm a, you've got amazing companies like Rockwell, and they will help your plant become safer or more digital. Fortunately, you don't really see a political element there. One thing I have noticed is companies are very different on whether they want to talk about COVID in their messaging. So there are companies like Cisco. Cisco, in my view, has the best online platform. I love WebEx. I think it's amazing. When Cisco is talking about promoting WebEx, it would be quite natural for them to say, you know, obviously in a post-COVID world, everyone's going to be working virtually and WebEx is the best solution. What I'm noticing is most companies are more cautious about even mentioning COVID. I can think of at least five companies we've worked with recently who would more likely say, you know, in this new environment we're all in, which is virtual. They're just making the assumption that you know it's COVID. In other words, they're sort of staying away from anything, I think, that has a political or even sensitive connotation. I think they're wise to do that. I think it's much harder in executive and leadership communications. I gave a keynote recently to the top, the speechwriters to the presidents of sort of the top 20 universities in North America, speechwriters to the head of like Stanford or whoever was in there. And I went through a list of things that they have to have a position on: COVID, Black Lives Matter, racial equality, Me Too movement, sports programs closing, dorm and education policies and procedures, why our fees aren't going down even though you're not in lectures anymore. The basket of topics that an executive has to talk on today is unlike any basket of topics I've seen in 40 years. There just was not this mountain of controversial topics. I mean, if you're a university president, you literally have had to have a position on Black Lives Matter, Me Too, university's response to COVID, shutting the sports program down. It's monumentally challenging. And if you're an executive, similarly, and also, by the way, what's your political view? I can't remember, was it Goya? I think the Hispanic food company was quite actively promoted by the current administration. That would be very interesting for any company. Like, okay, do we want to have an association with either administration or either political view of either side? I don't think there's ever been a more difficult time, actually, to be in communications from a leadership standpoint, because everything's the third rail, everything's explosive. And you have a very sensitized audience. Back to our earlier discussion on polarization. You're a university president and you take the wrong position on any of these socially inflammatory topics, you can get into a lot of hot water. And by the way, you look in the news, right? CEOs and university presidents are being dinged and or fired with regularity because they took the wrong position or they communicated poorly on these topics. That's the time you better be thinking about the structure of your message.
It's almost like you don't want to make the wrong mistake in this environment, right? You're going to make mistakes. You want to minimize them as much as possible. What effect has the virtual format had on providing a greater platform, a greater access for minority groups or other people that have not had the opportunity to have equal standing in communicating their messages?
That's very interesting. There's probably two or three answers to that. One is, in a sense, you can say that the move to virtual communication has been challenging and problematic, and in many ways it has. But there are some interesting little opportunities and positives within there also. One of them is access, right? If I'm somebody who, for whatever reason, anything from a disability or maybe I'm of a particular ethnic group or minority, or I'm a particular geography that just was unable, for example, to fly and be in a room physically, I can be in any room in the world virtually as long as I have reasonable bandwidth. And so I think that's a very interesting development that I might be a specialist in a certain topic. And ideally, in an ideal world, I'd love to fly all over the world and talk to people about my specialization. But it's just not possible because it's just so practically difficult. But I literally can be in the home or office of anyone in the world if I just have a web link. So I think in a sense, if there are disadvantaged groups of any kind, as long as they have access to a computer and some bandwidth, there's been a little bit of the leveling of the playing field there. Have we seen that yet? I don't know. But I do know, for example, in sales organizations, I might be a big industrial company and I have a specialist that just knows everything about, you know, something to do with the brewing industry. Well, that individual in the past would have had to have literally flown to every country in the world, but I could now put that guy in a boardroom of every single brewer in the world in one day or one week. So I think there's an as yet ununderstood or not understood phenomenon of access, which I think we'll be wanting to keep an eye on. I do think there's some other interesting dimensions to that. One of them is the way the virtual environment works is not the same for everybody. I'll give you an example. We did a workshop recently for a large technology company, and we did it for their up-and-coming women's leadership group, wonderful group of about 50 women. They're up-and-comers in this large technology company that you would know, but I won't tell you. And they all have a mentor. And we were working through our advanced communications course with at least an eye on what were the issues particularly that affect women. And just interesting things emerged. So, for example, one of the things we know about communication is that if a communicator displays a degree of authenticity, then that generally improves their credibility. But what we learned through a bunch of research and talking to some very, very senior women leaders before teaching this class is the acceptable band of that is narrower for women than it is for men. So let's imagine authenticity as sort of on the one hand, you know, you're really closed off, you don't reveal much of your personal humanity. On the other end, you're revealing a ton of your personal humanity. It seems, at least from anecdotal information, if nothing else, that a man can operate almost anywhere on that spectrum and still be okay. I could be up there and be all business, no personal. And that's okay. Or I could be really personal, like, hey guys, got to leave now. I'm going to my daughter's ballet recital. And everyone's like, oh, that's really nice. He's a man, he's really in touch with his feelings. In other words, it seems like the boundaries are wider. If you talk to, we interviewed 5 or 6 very, very senior women who we had met over the years from large companies. They all said, the acceptable band just seems to be narrower. It's so unfair. It's so unfair. If a woman says, oh, I've got to leave now to go to my daughter's ballet recital. Well, it's so odd. That's so much less acceptable for a woman to say that. But it's acceptable for a man to say that. That's absolutely crazy. It's totally unfair. But the women we spoke to said they kind of had to operate within a narrower band. And similarly, if you're really closed off on the far left of this spectrum, you're much more businesslike, a man that's seen as strong, but a woman can sometimes be accused of or criticized for not being feminine enough. Like, come on, you can't have it both ways, but it's entirely unfair. But it is definitely true that women, and by extension, I would say people of color, different ethnic minorities, other groups, I don't know the forces, but I suspect they're similar. That basically what I'm saying is the rules work slightly differently. And it's entirely unfair if you believe that anyone's communication should be based on merit and that the rules should apply equally to anyone. And I believe both of those things. It's horrible that that's true. But a lot of the women we spoke to ahead of this class and then on the class definitely felt that there were different rules for them. Now, I would say that doesn't have a whole lot to do with live face-to-face versus virtual. I don't think virtual created that. Almost all the women we spoke to said they were much more careful with their communications. And just taking that one example, particularly to try and hit that sweet spot in the middle of being not too robotic on the left, not too emotional. I mean, women would talk to us and say, they would accuse me of being shrill because I showed emotion, but a man would never have that accusation. So it just seems like the rules are different, in some ways unfair, because they are, it seems like, just to take this one example, women have to be much more careful about what's acceptable, as men, it seems, has more latitude across attributes like that.
Last question for you, Tim. What's the most important lesson or instruction that you want to leave with our listeners today?
If you're communicating, and it's reasonably high stakes, you know, you're not just chatting to a spouse or talking to your kids, but if you're communicating in a high stakes environment, assume that 80% of getting it right is about the structure of your message, and 20% of it is going to be about the delivery. And taking those in reverse, delivery matters, linguistic precision. Make sure your argument is ready to come out in the way you want it to. Don't be over-dependent on technology. Understand how your technology works that you are going to use. You know, display an appropriate amount of passion and authenticity. So those are your delivery things. But there's still only the 20 or 30. I would always assign 70 to 80% of the value of the importance of what you've got to get right in communication to the architecture of the message. Crisp, clean, simple, logical. It's a narrative flow. It's anchored in an audience priority. It's organized around a small number of powerful ideas, not a rambling mess of fact and data and statistics. And I wrote the books that way. I wrote the first book to be about message architecture, and the second book about message delivery. And unfortunately, both books came out before COVID. My overlay to that would be you have to understand how the virtual environment amplifies the kind of challenges that all communicators have. We actually have a really cool e-learning on this that does capture the dynamics of the virtual environment, but I'm not going to write a book about it, I don't think. I don't want to write another book. It's exhausting. But writing a book on virtual communication would be very interesting. That would be it. 70% of the importance is on structuring your message right, and then maybe 20 to 30 on just making sure you execute it right. Again, that's not eye contact or body language. It's linguistic precision and passion and energy. And then think very hard about making it work in the virtual environment.
Tim, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I really appreciate your sharing with our listeners your insights and observations.
Thank you. It was so much fun. I love talking about this stuff, as you can tell. And the rabbit hole goes so deep. And I was talking to my dentist recently, and like, how has your world changed? He's like, you know, not a whole lot. People are a bit more cautious and you have to wear a mask. And then I talked to the, you know, head of sales of a business unit of IBM, and it's unbelievable how things have changed. Some for the worse and some for the better, but it's a new world out there.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, produced by Peter Hoag and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guest contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time, when we will be joined by a trio of experts discussing the future of family-run businesses. I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you good health and prosperity.